British author Robert Harris has written a new novel called Pompeii. Like his previous novels, he starts with a historic event. In this case, the year is 79 AD, when Vesuvius erupted and buried the city of Pompeii, preserving its buildings and its people in a shell of ash. Vesuvius did not pour lava over the Italian countryside. Like Mount St. Helens, the mountaintop blew off. Rocks and ash poured out of the sky, and a wave of superheated gas destroyed everything that was left. In the novel, the first sign of danger comes when the Aqua Augusta, a massive aqueduct 60 miles long, goes dry. That starts the plot rolling toward the volcano, but the aqueduct fascinated author Robert Harris.
I just got very interested in Roman engineering in a kind of geekish way. And the more I got into it, the more interested I became. And in a way, I think the Aqua Augusta is the star of the book. And it was a quantum leap for civilization, the development of these aqueducts. It meant that men could live wherever they wanted and bring water to the place. They no longer had to site settlements next to wells or to rivers. And so everything changed because of aqueducts. You can see how obsessed I've become with them.
Well, the other thing that the Aqua Augusta does is it circles around Vesuvius. There is a point where it's going around behind Vesuvius, so that the volcano is between the aqueduct and Pompeii.
Yes, the Romans had no idea that Vesuvius was a volcano. They didn't even have a word in their language for volcano, in fact. But Vesuvius hadn't erupted since the Bronze Age, 1,500 years before, so they just thought it was a very fertile, very, very large mountain. And when I discovered that one of the things which would have happened before the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 AD was the mountain would have swelled, then it's quite logical to imagine that the swelling of the mountain would have broken the underground tunnel that the water was being carried in. And so this immediately then gave me my central character, an engineer who has to go and find out what's gone wrong.
Was there such a person?
Nobody knows really the identity of the men who ran the aqueducts. They're lost to history, which is one of the things that also motivated me to write the book. We only seem to have gladiators and emperors these days. I wanted to bring alive some of the characters who really made the Roman Empire, really the engineers that built the world. And I like the idea of using an engineer as a central character because it seemed to me that his thought processes must inevitably be fairly modern.
Now, in the novel, your young engineer falls in love. I mean, I suppose every novel has to have that. That's good. But you also have a tremendous amount of politics, the sort of politics and commerce and corruption of the Roman world, particularly the city of Pompeii, which you paint as a luxurious, evil place.
Well, Pompeii was a sort of boom town. It had been mostly or half destroyed by an earthquake 17 years before, but it was rebuilding, and the whole of the social structure of Pompeii had been shaken up. And I took as my lead character in Pompeii, a villainous character, but in real life he may not have been like that at all, but there was a man called Ampliatus, Numerius Papidius Ampliatus. He was a freed slave, and he gave to the town of Pompeii the Temple of Isis. And he must have been extremely rich to have done this, and he was a sort of symbol of the way in which one could rise from nowhere in Pompeii and make money. And
as a real estate developer, as it happens.
Yeah. Oh, yes. They're very, very modern. I mean, you can do two things with Rome. You can either stress how strange and weird it was, or actually, which seems to me more interesting, is just how extraordinarily similar to us they were. And he was a real estate developer. And my favourite line in the novel, insofar as a novelist is allowed to have a favourite line in his own book, is where he says to the engineer, "Take it from me, there's no safer investment than property in Pompeii."
Now, one of the things that you did in this book is, the title of it is Pompeii. We all understand that Pompeii was buried by the eruption of Vesuvius. We all know it's coming, but the people in the book don't know that, and we follow them all the way to the end when it does explode.
Yes, it's a risky thing for a novelist to do, especially a novelist like me who depends upon really story and engaging the reader and making them want to keep on going.
And sort of suspenseful things.
Yeah, you know the outcome. But actually, it works in one's favour. Every chapter in the book is preceded by a very dry scientific account of what was going on in the volcano, just a paragraph or two. And this has the effect, I think, of what the Greeks would have called dramatic irony. It's the equivalent of the chorus coming on stage before each scene and saying, "Oh, the gods are about to destroy everyone, you poor mortals," and then departing, and then you watch the drama. And oddly enough, I think the Greeks knew something about drama and tension. And I think it has it works, it's counterintuitive, I think, in a way. You get more and more tense because you know what's coming and the other people don't. And the supreme irony, of course, of the story, because the other thing, apart from the aqueduct, my other favourite character is Pliny the Elder, the great scientist, who he must have picked up these warning signs and wondered what they were. And he adds another layer of irony to the whole story.
So we have the young engineer and his broken aqueduct, the love story, the politics, the real estate developer and all of his corrupt associates, and it's all sort of rushing down toward a moment that we already know is coming, and since it's not going to surprise anybody that it does come, let me ask you to read the passage where Pliny the Elder sees Vesuvius erupt. He doesn't quite know what he's looking at, but he's an observer of nature.
He didn't even wait for his shoes. Instead, for the second time that day, he set off barefoot, lumbering across the dry grass towards the terrace. By the time he reached it, most of the household slaves were lining the balustrade, looking east across the bay toward what seemed like a gigantic umbrella pine made of smoke growing over the coast. A thick brown trunk with black and white blotches was rolling miles into the air, sprouting at its crown a clump of feathery branches. These broad leaves seemed in turn to be dissolving along their lower edges, beginning to rain a fine sand-coloured mist back down to the earth. "It can't be smoke," he thought. "It was too thick. Besides, there was no sign of any fire at the base. But if it was not smoke, what?" "Be quiet, damn you!" He waved at the slaves to stop their jabbering. Listening hard, it was just possible to make out a low and ceaseless rumble carrying across the bay. If that was how it sounded at a distance of 15 miles, what must it be like close up?
Robert Harris's book is called Pompeii. Mr. Harris, thank you very much.
A pleasure, Linda. Thank you.
That's All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.